WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. You can find us on the web at wslr.org. The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. During the 1980s, Ronald Reagan evoked the image of the welfare queen, a woman who made a very good living scamming the safety net. Reagan and subsequent administrations used this image to slash funding for programs assisting the poor and the working class. Now, a full-blown crisis of homelessness has sprung up in every major city and even in small towns and rural areas. The combination of low wages, unaffordable housing, and lax worker protections has created a class of impoverished working poor. In his book, There Is No Place for Us, Brian Goldstone follows several families as they fall into homelessness. Brian, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Boy, the stories in this book are harrowing. Families, mostly single mothers, are working very hard to stay housed. In the book, you write that, quote, today there isn't a single state, metropolitan area, or county in the United States where a full-time worker earning the local minimum wage can afford a two-bedroom apartment. Why are there so few affordable housing units?
Well, in many ways, I think it has to do with just the way housing has been treated in this country. It's been treated primarily as a commodity, as an investment vehicle, as a vehicle for accumulating wealth. And it's important that you began in your introduction with Ronald Reagan, because it was actually during the Reagan administration that a top HUD deputy said at one point, the federal government is getting out of the housing business, period. Up until that point, for generations, the government, since the 1930s, since the Depression, when public housing first emerged in this country, the federal government was very heavily involved in creating, subsidizing, building, producing affordable housing. When the federal government decided to sort of get out of the housing business, as that HUD deputy put it, the housing needs of America's citizens, and especially its low-income, poor, and working-class households, were left to the whims of the private market to supply their housing needs. And the supply of affordable housing just simply hasn't kept up with the need, the demand for it. Yeah, that statistic that you just cited about there not being a single city, state, or metro area in the country where a full-time minimum wage worker can afford just a modest two-bedroom apartment, that very succinctly just shows why we are seeing this homelessness and housing crisis continue to spiral.
How accurate are the government statistics on homelessness?
The statistics are wildly inaccurate. They are just a mammoth undercount of the true severity and magnitude of homelessness in this country. As bad as the official numbers are, in the last 2 years, the federal homeless census, known as the point in time count, has revealed the highest level of homelessness on record since that count began to be conducted in 2004. This is the highest count on record the last 2 years. But yeah, as bad as those numbers are, the reality is exponentially worse. There has been a concerted effort since the Reagan administration, since mass homelessness first erupted in this country, there has been a concerted effort first to obscure the actual causes of homelessness, the socioeconomic roots of this crisis, by diverting attention to things like mental illness, addiction, even calling homelessness a lifestyle choice or attributing it to a refusal to work and laziness. All of those things in the 1980s became dominant explanations for this burgeoning crisis, and that has continued into the present. But the attempt hasn't just been to obscure the root causes. It's also simultaneously been to narrow the lens on homelessness and allow us to see only the numbers of those who are on the streets, visible on the streets, or in shelters. And every year when that census is conducted and volunteers across the country fan out to count those experiencing homelessness, only those on the streets or in shelters are counted. Everyone else, all of the people who I write about in this book, families who are doubled or tripled up with others in overcrowded apartments, families who are living in these squalid extended stay motels and hotels, people who are living in their vehicles, all of those people, they literally don't count. They have been written out of the story that we have told about homelessness in this country. And by cobbling together different data sources, I show that the true scale of homelessness in this country is roughly, and this is a conservative estimate, 6 times greater than the official number. So we're talking about 4 million, roughly 4 million men, women, and children in this country who are deprived of a home right now. And here in Georgia, where I live and where the book is based, if you were to gather all of the families and individuals who are excluded from the official count just here in Georgia alone, you could fill the stadium where the Braves play 3 times over. That's how enormous this exclusion is. And that's a very deliberate thing. That is not accidental.
And most of these people are working one or more jobs, aren't they? Or do we know what percentage of the people who are unhoused are actually working full-time?
Well, recent research has shown that just those living on the street, researchers refer to that population as unsheltered homelessness. And those experiencing unsheltered homelessness, recent research has shown that roughly 40% of that population is employed in the formal low-wage labor market. About half of those living in homeless shelters are engaged in formal employment. But that's only, again, the population that is officially counted. Among those who are excluded, we don't have precise figures on the relationship between employment and homelessness among that population. But because the vast majority of that excluded population, what I say in this book is that those we see on the street or in shelters are just the tip of the iceberg. And my book is really about that immense iceberg underneath the water surface, because that immense iceberg under the water surface is overwhelmingly made up of families with children. Those are working people. The number of people even experiencing poverty in this country who are not on disability, in other words, they're, quote, able-bodied and they're working age but are not employed, is almost vanishingly negligible. I mean, just it's a very, very tiny percentage. So we don't have an exact number, but we can confidently say that the overwhelming number of people experiencing homelessness in this country right now are employed or are actively looking for work in the low-wage labor market.
That goes in the face of the myths about homelessness, that people don't want help or that they're so addicted or mentally ill that there's nothing we can do for them.
That's right. In this book, There Is No Place for Us, it is really about kind of the staggering rise of the working homeless, this phenomenon of the working homeless across the country. And I think what is so startling about that phrase, working homeless, is that it just immediately upends our prevailing assumptions about work and homelessness alike. On the homelessness side, as you say, I think there's an intuitive assumption among many people in this country, even well-intentioned people, that homeless people just need to get a job, that employment, job training, financial literacy, these sorts of things are an exit from this most extreme form of deprivation. And I think it's really shocking to discover, again, going back to that statistic, that a minimum wage worker can't afford housing anywhere in this country. People I'm writing about in this book, these 5 families who I followed over several years, they are working and working and working some more, and it is not enough. Forget about getting rich. We're talking about just being able to find this basic stability, this basic human necessity, a place to live. And on the work side of that term, there is an assumption that, again, if you just clock enough hours, if you just work hard enough, you might not be able to buy a mansion, but you'll at least be able to take care of your most basic material needs. And it's not just that wages are too low. It's not just that the minimum wage hasn't been raised in this country at the federal level since 2009. Meanwhile, rents have outpaced income gains since 1985 by 325%. It's not just that wages are too low, though. It's that the very nature of work has been transformed, and work itself has become ever more precarious and volatile, and people don't know from one week to the next how many hours are they going to be getting, or if they get sick, are they going to have any sick leave? And the overwhelming number of people who are employed in low-wage jobs, they don't have sick leave. One of the families who I write about in this book, the mom, she gets diagnosed with ovarian and breast cancer, and she's having to decide, does she go to her warehouse job or does she go to her chemo appointment? Because if she goes to her chemo appointment, she won't get paid. And if she doesn't get paid, she and her kids will be on the street. So that's the reality that the term working homeless points to, the mounting precarity associated with work and housing alike.
The families you follow are in Atlanta, Georgia, and you write that 93% of the homeless are Black. How does race figure into this?
Yeah, when I started reporting this book in about 2018, 2019, I had this desire to have a demographic diversity, that I would follow maybe a white working class family and a family of color. And as I began to report on this more and more, I would go to food pantries on a Saturday morning throughout Metro Atlanta. I would go to homeless service providers and agencies, and every single family I saw there was Black. And yeah, and I found that statistic that even though Atlanta is no longer a majority Black city, it once was, but because of gentrification and this much celebrated renaissance that the city has been undergoing, and maybe we can get back to that because that's a crucial kind of dynamic in that is fueling all of this insecurity. But I discovered that even though the city isn't majority Black any longer, 93% of the families experiencing homelessness are Black. And that has a history. That did not spring up overnight. The standard Wikipedia version of homelessness in America, the history of homelessness in America, it's a very white history. It's a history that begins in the colonial era and runs through the Civil War, when Civil War soldiers were returning to communities where they no longer had homes. And then it goes through Jacob Riis's Great Army of Tramps, and then into the Depression with Hoovervilles. But there's another alternative history of homelessness and housing precarity that we might tell, and that's a history that begins with 4 million formerly enslaved human beings being freed into a country where they are systematically deprived of ownership rights and property, and they are essentially forced into a labor economy of low wages, rent, and debt. And then as that history continues, they are systematically locked out of home ownership, and they are only allowed to live in certain areas of the country, in certain areas of the city. So an entire history, an entire legacy of displacement, of dispossession, of discrimination has given us that percentage, 93% of families experiencing homelessness are Black. And I just want to say that that racialized character of homelessness, that will vary in this country depending on the particular state or region or city that one is investigating. I was just in Minneapolis recently, and a disproportionate number of people who are homeless in Minneapolis are Indigenous and Native American. And there are areas of the country where the majority of people who are homeless are Latino or part of migrant worker communities. So it does vary by region, but homelessness is not colorblind.
How successful are programs like Section 8 housing? Because that's supposed to make up for the lack of affordable units, right?
It is. It is. And when the government decided, again, going back to the 80s, to get out of the housing business and began to initiate these public-private partnerships, and where the federal government was basically subsidizing rents for low-income families, the Section 8 voucher program was supposed to fill that need. But a couple of things to say about that. First of all, that voucher program was never funded at the level of the need that existed. So over the last many years, only 1 in 4 households in America who qualify for this housing voucher, who check all of the boxes, and we've made it very difficult to qualify for this essential form of assistance. We've said you can't have a criminal background, you have to be working, there's all sorts of requirements, but only 1 in 4 households who meet all of those requirements, who are poor enough to meet those requirements, actually receive this vital subsidy. And we use a lottery system to basically decide who is going to receive this assistance. And the fact that we even use the term lottery in relation to housing tells us something about how we've treated housing in this country.
Sarasota County homeowners affected by hurricanes Ian, Debbie, Helene, and or Milton can apply for assistance through the Resilient SRQ Housing Recovery Program to help repair or rebuild homes or reimburse eligible out-of-pocket expenses. Homeowners can begin the application process by completing a survey online through resilientsrq.net. The survey determines conditional eligibility. Full applications will be sent to eligible homeowners on a rolling basis. To qualify for the program, Sarasota County residents must meet income and other criteria. More information and assistance completing the survey is available by calling 941-861-5309 or emailing info@resilientsrq.net. You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest is Brian Goldstone, and we're talking about his book, There Is No Place for Us. We were talking about the Section 8 housing vouchers.
But those who are lucky enough to actually get the voucher, who win the lottery, one of the families I write about in the book, the mom's name is Britt. She ends up getting a voucher. When the book opens, she has decided that this voucher is the key to her being able to remain in the city of her birth here in Atlanta. Her roots in the city go back 5 generations, and she realizes the only way she's ever going to be able to afford a home for her and her children in the city is through this voucher. She finally gets one, and then, tragically, she can't find a single landlord who will accept it. And it ends up expiring before she can use it, before she can find a landlord to accept it. And she loses the voucher. And the year that that happened to her, something like 1,600 vouchers in Atlanta were issued to families, and close to 1,100 expired before they could be used. Because again, we've said we are going to look to the private market, to private landlords. But when it's not financially beneficial for landlords to accept this voucher, they have every right to refuse to accept one. And in a city like Atlanta, where the rental market is hot as real estate, in a competitive rental market, landlords have no incentive to take these vouchers. And this is being replicated in cities across the country.
The other obstacle the families face is even if they're able to save up enough money, if they have a low credit score, they can't find a place to rent. Can you talk a little bit about credit scores and some of the reasons why people have bad credit?
I'm an anthropologist by training. And one thing that we as anthropologists like to do, those of us who teach anthropology and Anthro 101 courses, we like to say to students that anthropology is about making the familiar strange, taking things that we take for granted and kind of looking at them anew. And credit scores are something that, as an anthropologist, I'm just continually stunned by. It's almost like out of a Black Mirror episode where this 3-digit number has come to determine whether millions of people in this country are able to access something as fundamental as just a home, as a roof overhead. And the things that can tank your credit score, everything from medical debt to student loan debt, to an eviction on your record, whether that eviction was unjust, whether that eviction was the result of you reporting unsafe conditions to the health authorities and your landlord deciding to retaliate against you and evict you, it doesn't matter what the reason is. As soon as that eviction, even a filing, even an eviction filing, you don't even have to, the judge doesn't even have to put you out of your home. The judge can decide, no, this is not right. This person has a right to stay in their home. Even having an eviction filed against you in some states is enough to tank your credit score. And once that score goes below a certain threshold, you are in effect pushed out of the housing market. You're pushed out of the possibility of being able to rent a home. And at that point, families, and we're not talking about just a few here and there, we're talking about really the vast majority of that 4 million number that I cited earlier about people who are experiencing homelessness right now. Once they lose access to the formal rental market, they are pushed into what I refer to as a kind of shadow realm. It's a world of homelessness that we don't see. It's a world comprised of, yes, vehicles, people sleeping in their cars and minivans and the overcrowded apartments of others. But above all, that world is comprised of these extended stay hotels. And these hotels are extremely profitable homeless shelters, basically, where school buses pull up every morning to pick up children who are living there not for months, but for years. And their parents have these low credit scores. They are paying by the week these extortionate rates at these hotels and motels with slum-like conditions, and they are unable to get out because no one will rent to them. And one of the families in my book who lives in one of these hotels refers to it as an expensive prison, because almost 90%, 100% of their income is going just to paying for their room each week. And if they miss even a single day, they can be locked out, but they have nowhere else to go.
The other factor that's been pushing families out is the rise of the private equity markets buying up rental homes. There was one family where they were going to be evicted. It went to court. The judge ruled that they weren't going to be evicted. But the next time they were one day late on their rent, they got evicted. It's like there is absolutely no protection for the people renting.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that family. Their names are Maurice and Natalia, and they defy all of the stereotypes one might harbor about homeless people. It's a two-parent household. They have these middle-class aspirations and a number of, you know, unforeseen events in their life, postpartum depression that Natalia experiences. After they had been stably housed for many years, their landlord deciding to sell this rental property for a profit and pushing Maurice and Natalia into what a case manager in the book calls the housing hunger games, where you're left to fend for yourself. And so, yes, they end up in this apartment that is way more than they can afford. And they have the misfortune of ending up, as so many have today, in an apartment complex that is owned by a private equity firm called Covenant Capital, based in Nashville, Tennessee. And in the past, when they were late on their rent, they could call their landlord and say, we're going to be a few days late. And she would say, that's fine. Just make sure it's in by the end of the week. There was not even a person to talk to. When you call the customer service number, the management office, there wasn't even a human being to talk to. And they ended up getting evicted through this automated eviction system. And this is a growing trend where these corporate landlords are basically evicting people en masse through these algorithmic eviction methods. And you get an automatic filing against you after a certain number of days that your rent is late, and there's just no margin. There's nothing to negotiate. You're then saddled with the late fees. You're saddled with the court costs. And these landlords know that if one family is pushed out, there will be another two, three, four ready to immediately take their place in that apartment. What is really perverse about Maurice and Natalia's situation is once they become homeless, once they are evicted, and they end up living in this hotel room at Extended Stay America. During the pandemic, Blackstone and Starwood Capital, these two private equity giants, These private equity firms, they're not only buying up increasing swaths of America's rental housing. Private equity firms like Blackstone and Starwood Capital, they saw during the pandemic how profitable these extended stay hotels are because they are effectively housing of last resort, their shelter of last resort for the casualties of America's housing crisis. They bought Extended Stay America for $6 billion during the pandemic, and Maurice and Natalia end up in a hotel room at Extended Stay America. And in the span of 8 months, they spent $17,000 on their hotel rent for this studio-sized hotel room that had cockroaches running across the floor and water dripping from the ceiling. And their two-bedroom apartment down the street that they had been evicted from was, this hotel room was more than double what they were paying for that apartment. There's this James Baldwin line that's very famous about how extremely expensive it is to be poor in America. I think circumstances, situations like Maurice and Natalia's show how extremely lucrative all of this insecurity has become for some in this country.
And then the other way that the landlords extract money from people is they have to apply to be able to even be told whether or not they're going to be able to rent a place. And the fees run anywhere from $50 to $200 just to be considered for a rental. And they put that money out. There's no way to recoup it if the landlord says, yep, no, we're not going to do it. So who's making money off of those fees?
Who indeed? Those fees are basically just boosting the revenues of property management companies and landlords. Natalia, when she and her husband are looking for an apartment and she's seeing that just to apply for an apartment, you have to pay not only $80, $90 per adult to apply, and that money is non-refundable, but these apartments are also now demanding $150, $200 administrative fee that is also paid upfront and non-refundable, even if you're rejected. And she says, how can this be? Why are they doing this? And then she answers her own question, because they can, because nobody is stopping them, because so many states like Georgia are just these unregulated Wild Wests where the power asymmetry between landlords and tenants are concerned. There's a term for this. It's price gouging. It's seeing that there's an emergency and extracting as much profit as possible from those in desperation in the midst of that emergency. That is what is happening right now. That is what these fees are an expression of, but we don't call that price gouging. We just call that the housing market. We just call that supply and demand economics. But price gouging, I think, is the correct term for it.
And all of this that you write about was before Trump and Doge. And I can't imagine that things are going to get better under this administration.
Yeah, I mean, there really are no words to describe how catastrophic this is, what we're seeing right now. It is just utterly terrifying to see that an already threadbare social safety net, an already threadbare system for assisting these families who, again, are not on the fringes of society. These are the very workers, the very laborers whose labor is powering the growth of our economy, who's powering the success, the renaissance of our cities. These are people who, through their work, are taking care of our children, taking care of our elders, who are delivering our boxes for Amazon and delivering food for DoorDash and Uber Eats. These people are doing essential work. They are not only being pushed out of the neighborhoods they grew up in, but they're increasingly being pushed out of housing altogether. That was already happening before, you know, before Trump was reelected. And to see what's happening now with basically a big bucket of gasoline just being dumped on this already disastrous situation is really harrowing to witness. But I do want to emphasize that the abandonment of poor and working class people in this country has been a bipartisan phenomenon. This has been the engineered neglect that has produced this crisis. The responsibility is not only Republicans for this catastrophe that we're witnessing today. This has been a bipartisan phenomenon, and I think it's important for us to just be honest about that.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest is